You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 30th, 2015, Lenny Sorensen presented the sixth and final part in our CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. In 1820, only 12% of the enslaved had been born in Africa. By the decade leading to the Civil War, American slaves were Christian, with English as their first and only language, says Sorensen in this interesting talk about the role slaves played in the development of the plantation system. Lenny Sorensen majored in history at Mary Baldwin and earned her M.A. and Ph.D. in American Studies at the College of William and Mary. For over 30 years, she worked as a university lecturer, museum consultant, hands-on presenter, and researcher with a focus on African-American slavery, American agriculture, and women's work in colonial and post-colonial America. Formerly Monticello's African-American research historian, Ms. Sorensen teaches rural life skills such as canning, butchery, and cookery from her home in western Albemarle County. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Slavery and Plantations. Here's Lenny Sorensen.
Thank you. Rural life skills are actually butchering chickens. I just tried to figure out what could you say nicely on a card that wouldn't make people have to lose their lunch when you offered it to them. Okay, we have the man there who's going to do the slides, I understand. Okay. You know, it's an interesting time to be at the 150th. I have a feeling that all of us were here at the 100th in the 60s.
Hold on a second.
Am I not loud enough?
Yeah, let me lean this into you.
I thought he gave me this thing.
That's a separate one.
Oh, that's a separate thing.
That's a separate one.
Oh, okay. I have a separate and a. Okay. My God, I've got to rub my hand. Okay. And the tone of these two different, these 50-year-apart celebrations are very, very interesting to me as I think back to that time. I certainly had no idea that I would be living in Virginia all these years ago, all these years later. But what really strikes me about being here, and particularly being in Albemarle, is that, you know, we just travel around on our daily business, all of us, going from place to place, and you know, we're visiting friends and museums and festivals, and just every single road, little crossroads towns, things like Doom. I just drove through Doom the other day. You encounter battlefields and old taverns and plantations just in the daily run of our lives, not in any particular special way. And of course, at the time, it was the oldest and the largest southern state 150 years ago. And I think almost everybody probably in this room has visited Montpelier and certainly Monticello. Can I have slide two, please? But what I'd like you to do as you kind of, you can jump off from this image if you'd like, is to really picture those same roads, those same journeys that you take, those ways that you zip out to Fork Union or you run up to Orange County, and picture every road, Garth, Three Notched, all of the places unpaved, everywhere that you see a bridge. If it's deep enough, there was a ferry. If it was shallow, it had a ford, and you would have had to have forded that road. And along every dirt road, and every livery stable, at every inn, at every plantation, in every tavern, in every place, there would have been black people. And certainly, the vast majority of them would have been enslaved. It's changed. Across this state and certainly across most of the South, hundreds of thousands of slaves filled every position within the world of the plantation. The majority were field laborers, of course. But, as well, there were wagoners, postilions, coachmen, blacksmiths, Wheelwrights, valets, butlers, cooks, nursemaids, wet nurses, housemaids, seamstresses, spinners, weavers, and even the occasional overseer. In the 1860 census on the eve of the Civil War, Albemarle County counted 13,916 slaves and 606 free blacks. Whites numbered 12,103, of whom 1,953 were slave owners. Now, these figures leave out the tradesmen and milliners and wheelwrights and carpenters and hotel keepers and tanners and couriers and gunsmiths and land-owning farmers who hired slave labor on an annual basis. Slide four. In the upper tier of southern states, plantations were mixed farming operations with combinations of wheat and other small grain production or tobacco production, often in tandem with intensive animal husbandry. Agricultural variety on a plantation might include raising beef cattle or dairy cows or breeding and training oxen or mules. Certainly George Washington's Mount Vernon was very famous for the mules. A plantation might be known for raising horses for the saddle or for racing or as carriage beasts. On farms and plantations, one would have found sheep, goats, all manner of domestic fowl, and of course the ubiquitous hog. There were plantations that specialized in building timber, barrel staves, furniture grade lumber, pine tar, or hemp for rope. Pork and beef, butchered, salted, and barreled along with corn, was sold on the international market, especially to the Caribbean sugar islands with their hundreds of thousands of enslaved laborers. By 1820, plantations on the Upper South, and we're going to call Virginia, Maryland, Tennessee, Kentucky, were for the most part peopled by Afro-Americans of second, third, fourth, and even fifth generation American birth. In 1820, only 12% of the enslaved had been born in Africa. So we have a very highly Americanized population. And certainly by the decade leading to the Civil War, American slaves were Christian, with English their first and only language to the greatest degree. And while their legal and social condition separated Afro-Southerners from the mainstream of white laborers, often their skills, dress, and food ways were quite similar to those of the poorest white tenant farmers or the poorest wage laborer. Afro-Southerners were also well within the age demographics of the time. In the 1850s, over 50% of Americans, white and black, were 20 years of age or younger. Okay? So when we think about these people of the past, and when we think about them in the Civil War era, it's really important to really get a sense of the fact that they are not us. And to give you a sense of how that has changed over time, 1899 is 44%, 1940, 18%, and in 2000, 14%. So we are now a nation of mature and older people. Mature and older people look at life differently. We behave differently. We have different values. We have matured in the ways that we cherish different aspects of our culture. Consequently, with this very deeply young population, we have a demographic also of very high alcohol ingestion. One of the figures I heard was in 1805, the per capita intake of hard spirits. This is not counting wine, beer, and even hard cider, but just hard spirits was 5 gallons per person per annum. Now, when you consider all these many young ones who were too young to drink, and I'm going to say under 12, okay, well, because it was a pretty loose culture, right? There's a whole lot of folks drinking a whole lot of liquor, and they're very young. And what happens in a culture where you have a combination of youth and alcohol? Youth and alcohol equal what?
A university.
Thank you. Yes, as Mr. Jefferson discovered at his university. If you read, there's been some wonderful books written on that. Okay, youth. No, that's a lovely interruption. Youth and alcohol tends to equate or equal violence. So when we look at the violence, not merely as that perpetuated in war, but the violence within the culture, the violence against women, against each other, against slaves, against animals. Okay, we can better understand, not condone certainly, but understand where all that violence comes from with such a huge preponderance of very young people. Now, by 1820, cotton really had become king across the South. It had increased in numbers. In 1791, the whole country exported only 889 bales of cotton. In 1795, the figure jumps to 28,000. So obviously, Mr. Whitney's thing there was, you know. By 1801, it had reached 92,000 bales. And by 1820, exports reached close to 500,000 bales, and it just kept accelerating from there. There were certainly downside times and up times. There were depressions, and there were bubbles, and there were all those things. But on the whole, the price of cotton, the investment in the production of cotton was always a very good deal. So while the numerical majority of slaves worked in these monocrops of cotton and tobacco and rice and sugar, there were always slaves participating in building construction, in manufacture, in domestic service, and a very visible presence in small town life and urban environments. Just to parenthetically add, Baltimore was one of the centers of the hiring of industrial slaves. It had the largest, they produced chemicals and all manner, they had potash and all kinds of chemical production. So just if we want to think about current events and what does that mean, the history of Baltimore is embedded in the use and the bringing in from outside the immediate environs hundreds of thousands of slaves coming in to work in industry. But, slide six, please. But you have to remember that all the production of the plantation, all of it, had to leave to be carried to the marketplace. Okay? And whether the market's near or distant, if it's Orange to Orange, or if it's to Charlottesville, or if it's to Richmond, or if it's to Charleston, or it's to Natchez, or it's to D.C., or ultimately to the Caribbean, wherever, it has to be taken there. And when it has been delivered, then those same men that hauled those wagons pick up whatever is on the delivery list to be brought back. And that's where you find the fine furniture and the chinaware and the saddles and the books and the Madeira wine and the nutmegs and the lemons and the ribbons that are part of what we think of as the graceful living aspects of the plantation. And it was brought by wagoners experienced in the world of transportation by river and road. And so we want to make sure that we understand the permeability and the flexibility and the ways in which slavery kind of is across geography as well as time, happening in different ways, so such that even very isolated places like Montpelier, you know, you have to drive, even now, it takes a bit to get there, and there's not a lot of other houses, and you think, oh, well, okay, this is way out in the country. And yet, people, certainly slave owners, understood or had some sense. Slide seven, please. James Madison decided not to pursue his escaped slave Billy, to return him to the plantation. And why did he do that? Well, he tells us in his own words when he says that the boy had likely, quote, been contaminated by freedom, unquote. I find that one of the most chilling phrases, and I can hardly say it without weeping. And of course, during his stay in Philadelphia with Madison. Of course, such contamination might very well be infectious, even in so rural and isolated a place as Orange County. Now, one of the major components of our understanding of the realities of plantation slavery in the antebellum is the ubiquitous nature of the interstate slave trade, which replaced the international our participation in international slave trade in 1808, when the United States removed itself from that trade. Between 1790 and 1860, white Americans transported from the Upper South to the opening Lower South more than 1 million African American slaves, one of the largest forced exiles in the world, in the history of the world, actually. And two-thirds of them left as a result of either direct sale or estate sales upon the death of masters. Those are the two primary reasons. When you see the ads for slave sales here in Albemarle County, which can be found in the archived pages of the Richmond newspapers and the local papers, and of course with every sale, with every displacement, even when people picked up and took all of their best and strongest, youngest workers and took them up as a body and took them to Arkansas to start a plantation, they would sell generally all of the elder, the children, whatever. And so in any case, there would have been a wrenching and permanent separation of family and generations and communities. The rate for a prime field hand in New Orleans in 1800 was about $500. And on the eve of the Civil War, it was $1,800. So again, with downfalls sometimes in the market and other types of depression, there would have been ups and downs, but the prices were always increasing, and even so, financially inept or unlucky, whichever way you like to think about it, a man, as Thomas Jefferson noted, that, quote, a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm, unquote. Repugnant, but logical, right? Slide 8, please. Sale and the threat of sale, as exemplified by the phrase, I'll put you in my pocket. I'll put you in my pocket. Generally acted as an incentive to keep slaves compliant, but despite fear of sale or other punishment, many thousands of plantation slaves ran away within the South. The historian John Hope Franklin estimated that there were as many as 100,000 internal fugitives at any given time during the 1840s and 50s. These are not people heading to Philadelphia. These are people who have dropped below the radar within their local communities or regionally and are kind of operating the way today we might use as a rough analogy, undocumented workers of various sorts. So what was the daily life like on the plantation? Slaves were obliged by law to obey their masters in all things. And Judge Ruffin of the North Carolina Supreme Court said it the most succinctly in his 1826 decision, quote, the power of the master must be absolute so as to render the submission of the slave perfect, unquote. The power of the master must be absolute so as to render the submission of the slave perfect, unquote. Now, the power of the master extended to work hours, courtship and marriage, child naming, punishment, food rations, religion, gardens, permission to barter or work for oneself in your off time, or clothing rations or types of dwellings, indeed, every aspect of slave life. Slide 9. Now, of course, not all masters were interested in all those topics. The ones they were interested in were the ones that they had absolute legal right to maintain. But of course, because slaves were people with ideas about their own lives, the job of the slave master was a constant worry because, quote, this most difficult species of property, unquote, which is a phrase often used and becomes kind of a trope that you'll find. In terms of complaints about slave behavior, these people just refused to readily comply. And whining about slaves' attitudes is a common refrain in the pages of planters' diaries and letters. And of course, we now live in a time when we have been able to use fabulous technology to digitally reproduce and reveal, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that any of us who want to take time to read or go to the Library of Congress or go to other university archives and read, we can read this stuff ourselves. And that is a most fabulous thing because they belong to us. All of that information is ours. And as we read it and learn it and share it from that primary documentation, it's an important gift that we give to all the people that we might discuss a topic like this with, when we can just say, oh, yeah, go to the LOC. Here's a link. You can read that. I didn't make this up. You know, I don't have an agenda. I don't have a dog in this race. That's what he said. That's what she said. You know, those are really great positions. Now, Jefferson, and of course we fall back on Jefferson because for a lot of details, partly because he just left this tremendous volume of written material, and that's just a boon to any historian at all. Now, he always encouraged his slaves to marry, quote, within the plantation family, unquote. That's what he called it. But with few exceptions, folks insisted on finding mates abroad on other plantations. Part of it was that he lived in a world, in his elite stratum, where it was very common for first cousins, really close first cousins. We're talking about both eyes on that side of the head, first cousins, to marry. And nobody thought a thing of it, you know, and if you had a... In almost all West African cultures, and certainly as just a tradition, as some kind of a cultural holdover, although most people couldn't possibly have even probably at the time told you why it is they knew this, even second cousin was too close. Okay, so Elizabeth Hemming with her 87, you know, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren on the map, no, they couldn't find anybody to marry up there, and they weren't going to do it. And so at his death, two-thirds of the men and half of the women at Monticello had abroad spouses. Okay, even with the inducement of a pot, an extra iron pot and an extra blanket as a, you know what I mean, they couldn't be induced. So masters might demand that slaves eat in communal kitchens, you know, only to find that families and individuals would go to quite extraordinary lengths to use their meager food rations to cook and eat in arrangements that were more agreeable to themselves. Now, some masters insisted that the slaves augment their meager rations, which tended to be about 2 to 5 pounds of salt pork and a peck of cornmeal per week for an adult laborer, and half that for a half hand and a quarter of that for a quarter hand. And if you were really old and you didn't work, you didn't get anything. And if you were a baby, a knee baby didn't work, you didn't get anything. So that means the whole community, that's how those folks got fed. So having gardens, if he insists that you have a garden, a self-grown garden produce, but he might insist that you had to work it on your own time with no time left over. Jefferson worked his slaves 5.5 days. Many others only worked their slaves 5 days so that they could be off on Sunday or whatever. So there was all kind of different ways. The master could do anything he wanted to. There were no rules. Okay. Others wanted their slaves to only eat what was produced under the supervision of the master, and thus tried to create large overseen vegetable gardens that were essentially communal. People resisted that as well. They wanted their own food in their own cabins. They wanted their own gardens. They wanted their own, you know, they truly understood that notion. So slaves that were in a position to garner tips from white plantation guests or sale of garden truck or chickens or eggs could buy better clothing or cookware or sugar or whiskey or presents for their plantation-bound relatives. And we see that in the archaeological record. You know, but when we find all those in the archaeological record of slave cabins, we find a machine, commercially produced buttons. Only men wore buttons well through most of the 19th century. Women didn't wear buttons. They didn't button their clothes. They tied their clothes, partly because they were either pregnant or not pregnant or nursing or not nursing, you know. So the boys, and they all wore, you're all familiar with sailor pants, you know, the buttons, okay. They've all got pants. And while they're little and they're young, they might have to carve a few out of some wood and maybe a few out of bone. But by God, as soon as they get themselves a few little pennies, they're going to go down to the general store and buy some pretty buttons. And so the buttons are men's that you see in those sites, which is really kind of an interesting take on the permeability of slavery, where they get it, how they get it, what do they feel about it, that kind of thing. And so it was always, it wasn't Sing Sing. And I can't tell you how nice it is to be able to use the reference Sing Sing to a group of people and actually have you know what the hell I'm talking about. I have had college students sit there with doe eyes looking at me. And they haven't even heard of Attica. Now, in the two decades before his death, Thomas Jefferson owned the labor of 136 or so people at Monticello. Among them were skilled agriculturalists, blacksmiths, nail makers, wheelwrights, coopers, and weavers. For over 20 years, each of Jefferson's 11 grandchildren in turn were cared for by the dedicated slave nurse Priscilla Hemings. He trusted his butler to supervise the household servants, to carry the keys to the wine cellar, possibly the most famous wine cellar in the history of wine. After Caligula. I could not resist that. I knew that you'd know who the hell I was talking about. And Colbert was indeed expected to welcome visitors of the highest social status, James and Dolly Madison, and indeed General Lafayette when he was visited. And given Jefferson's reputation as a gourmet, we really must not forget, we cannot and we must not forget, that that reputation rests squarely on the shoulders of a series of enslaved chefs at both the President's House in Washington and at Monticello. Now, even the menu at his dining table many times depended on being able to purchase foods grown by entrepreneurial slaves in their gardens and chicken yards scattered across the Monticello landscape. When he came home for his summer vacation during his time at the President's House, when he had hired out much of his slave labor, his laborers, and the garden had not been finished yet, that's where he bought the food, and we have the record of it, which is, again, a really wonderful thing. Slide. So raising cattle, sheep, and swine, butchering, salting, smoking meat, planting, harvesting, drying, and preserving vegetable foods for the winter, making butter and cheeses, bread baking, brewing both beer and distilled liquor and cider were all part of the knowledge that black people used in their daily work for white plantations and farm households. Now, certainly such a wealth of traditional skills flies in the face of Thomas Jefferson's opinion that a major impediment for freeing slaves was that, quote, "For men probably of any color but of this color we know, brought from their infancy without necessity for thought or forecast, are by their habits rendered as incapable as children of taking care of themselves and are extinguished promptly wherever industry is necessary for raising young," unquote. And he gave this dire prediction in a letter to Edward Coles dated August 25th, 1814. When all of the people that I mentioned earlier were all on the mountain doing what they were doing. Now, Jefferson was expressing in 1814 what would become the slave owner's ideological mantra for the remaining years of American slavery. A slave-owning physician in Georgia in 1858 echoed these very same words of an assessment of slaves as a class. Quote, "Everybody knows that Negroes are deficient in reason, judgment, and forecast." He didn't read that letter, but he used the same language. "That they are improvident and thoughtless of the future and contented and happy in the enjoyment of the mere animal pleasures of the present moment." Slide 11. This from the very Southerners who for over 200 years had allowed these people so deficient of reason and improvident to not only till their profitable fields, but to cook in their kitchens and serve at their tables and care for and nurse their young and carry their valuables to market. And on a more lighthearted note, to provide fiddle music for dances and wedding parties for their white daughters and their swains. The sale of slaves was lucrative And the ownership of slaves continued to be vitally important to slave owners in the important months of the opening months of the war. This economic importance is reflected in the U.S. Census figures for 1860, that great photograph of the last, of the end of the antebellum that we can turn to see, okay, what was it like just before? In that last census, the total value of slave property in the South was estimated to be worth $3 billion. That's in their money. As opposed to, or in contrast to, the total of land owned in the slave-owning states of $2,412,000,000. The enormous value of the southern slave population is striking when placed in some other comparative perspectives. That $3 billion was roughly three times greater than the total amount of all capital, North and South combined, invested in manufacturing. It was also three times the value of the entire U.S. livestock population. And it was 48 times the total expenditure of the U.S. federal government that year of 1860. Now, clearly, no one was going to give that up easily. The Southern rationale, argued later in early 20th century historiography, Cash et al., who wrote textbooks and were part of the UVA scene, I had to mention that, that slavery was due to make a natural end on its own because of its unprofitability, truly does not hold up under scrutiny. However one phrased it, slavery was certainly the driving engine in the order of secession in 1861, as the states with the highest percentage of slaves, with the most to lose in that economic pie, were the first to secede, and in that order. Now, the war itself, of course, brought reality crashing down upon the entire plantation South. With the blockade, which was unexpected, I think, the South was really taken aback by that. The necessity for plantations to ramp up production of foodstuffs and the decline in cotton and sugar production, planters, quote, wondered how they could keep their slaves occupied and afford their upkeep under such conditions. So these begin to be issues that are discussed in the newspapers. And as historian Armstead Robinson has argued, the fall then came from within as well as from without. The plantation South simply crumbled, unable to withstand African-American challenges to slavery, as well as the burdens of blockades, wartime production, and invading armies. Because of the blinding ideology that bolstered the rationalizations of the continued need for slavery, the South was ill-prepared to understand the behavior of their plantation slaves during the era of the Underground Railroad in the 1840s and 50s, with its thousands of successful freedom-bound fugitives. These are the ones who didn't submerge themselves and stay. They went to Boston, they went to Philadelphia, they went to England, they talked on the abolition circuit, they wrote books. They told what they had experienced, and the South was outraged. And then, of course, Miss Stowe wrote her famous book, which had come out of that. They were just completely blown out during the war, when slaves would be out in the field and they'd hear the rumble of cannon, and they'd literally just drop their tools and walk away. Slide. And they would go, and they would leave. And even when they got there, you know, things would be, they didn't know what they were going to face. They had no idea, but they went. And they went in great numbers. And slave owners, if you read the letters and the diaries of those months, were boggled, dismayed. You have to write the 250-word essay.
Somebody didn't turn it off.
Yep, see, I told them. Anyway, and then, of course, the idea that freemen in the North, and may I have that next slide, would enlist to fight with the Union.
Sorry.
It's okay, darling. It used to happen to me all the time until I learned how to fix it, so, you know.
Nobody ever
calls me. Yeah, see, except for right now. That's right, yeah. Listen, we all grew up with phones that did that. Okay, so, you know, don't worry about it. It's just, you know. The next slide. There we go. The idea that black men would join the military and would fight in the South again was an idea that the South was not prepared for, because of, as I think, you know, this ongoing, you know, 50 years of ideology. Now, after the Civil War, the ex-slaves resisted being hired as debt peons on the very plantations from which they had been freed. It was a decade after the war, it was in the decade after the war that emancipated African Americans set out to do some very basic and important stuff. Next slide. To regularize marriages within the churches of their choice, often finding long separated spouses and children, to save pennies and nickels in the Freedmen's Bank. By a year and a half out from the fall of Richmond, the Freedmen's Penny Bank had $187,000 in nickels and pennies saved by black people. To buy land when and where it was possible, and of course to make every attempt to educate themselves and their children. In other words, to become Americans. Last slide. One thing they did not do. What is the thing they did not do? They did not raise their hand against their former owners. They did not rise up. They did not kill. They did not murder. They did not mutilate. They did not. Okay. And I give that as an example because in 1831, when Nat Turner and his small band of rebels murdered 57 people, the outflow was that well over 350 black people in surrounding counties were beheaded and their heads exhibited on pikes on the roadsides and left as warning. So, I think that we can safely say that the seeds, or at least many of the seeds of the Civil War, were sown in the mid-18th century plantation economy, and these roots were nurtured by the actions of the and the inactions of the founding fathers as we went through the early federal period. But equally instrumental, as these founders died and the nation matured, came their sons and grandsons and great-grandsons, men of the burgeoning Industrial Revolution, all more determined than ever to hold on to their enslaved property and the wealth it brought them. And it is in that persistence that they ensured the bitter harvest of war. Thank you. And now we can talk. Hi. Yes?
If a black slave, a man, was in good health, what was his lifespan?
Well, you know, pretty much lifespans. Yes, she asked about the lifespan of perhaps a healthy person, a male worker. Pretty much, you know, a lot of lifespans for everybody were low because epidemiology being what it was, and, you know, even really wealthy people got typhus, and everybody got tuberculosis, and, you know, wealthy whites stayed a little healthier only because they had people to haul water and wash laundry and haul their, you know, but. You got to remember that all those chamber pots, they just got thrown outside. Most people did not have dug privies. That, you know, there's a good documentary record of, we all know where Buck Mountain is, pretty much have a sense of Buck Mountain. Okay, well, just right there is the Julius Catterton place, and you're going to be next, I promise you. And in that plantation, in maybe the 40s, the way the slave cabins were down by the bottom where the branch goes through there, and it flooded and went through, and 14 miles downstream they had a big typhus epidemic. Okay, you can just follow it right on the map. So a lot of things happen in terms of maybe giving a broad. Blacks generally had a shorter, because they partly because they had higher death rates at neonatal death rates. That's really part of what that is. Partly because from neonatal tetanus and other forms that don't have anything to do with birthing itself, but have to do with epidemiology. So, but you know, if you were a man and you managed to survive being gored by any animal with horns, okay, being stepped on by any animal with feet, big, large, ox, you know, breaking your feet, breaking your bones, being rolled over by any of those damn wheels, big wheels, broken. So if you could survive, and then you just survive the ills of childhood, which, you know, and then kind of manage to get past that most vigorous age when you were right in the fray where you were going to get burnt or stabbed or poked or run over or all of that stuff. And once you got a certain age, you might hang in there a while if you had access to food and, you know. Yeah. With women, if you got past the childhood diseases and then could just manage somehow to get through your childbearing years, then you also had a chance of survival. So in that, 40 to 35% of people that are over, you know, a certain age, there's a significant number of real elders in there. I mean, look at Thomas Jefferson. He lived till he was, you know, he was of a class that he had been cared for. He had been succored all his life. But he still, of course, if there'd been a tremendous he actually was immunized. So, but you know, if there'd been typhus or yellow fever or cholera, then we, you know, things might have been really different. So I'm not trying to not give you a figure. I'm just saying that we have to look at that kind of more nuanced. Yes, ma'am.
Slave?
Not usually. No. Or, and there was a law that had been, and she asked about marriage. Most marriages for the enslaved were very informal, and they may have had someone in their community who was thought of by both themselves and the master as being kind of the deacon or the preacher of their community. Some people did actually belong to Baptist congregations, so I mean there's kind of a lot of variance, but marriage ceremonies for black people never included "till death do us part" by law, because of course you could always sell somebody. So when I say that people went to regularize their marriages, that's one of the reasons, is that many people had been sold away from spouses over the years. There's some real, if you're interested in the history of Virginia Baptists, the material of that comes out of the experience of Reverend Ryland, who was the white preacher at the First African Baptist Church in Richmond. That material that's at the Library of Virginia is just incredibly, wonderfully fascinating material of how particularly urban blacks who were members of actual congregations like First African Baptist, when they would go to another, be sold to another place, they often would have somebody write back to Reverend Ryland to get their, and I don't want to misspeak the name, it's a kind of it's a statement that they were affirmed or confirmed or baptized, you know, properly within the church, and that they were not backsliders or whatever, and then so that they could join another congregation. So you have it as kind of formal as that, all the way down to people who literally just announce that they're going to live together / marry. You know, people are using the same language. There's only so many ways you can talk about, you know, a man and a woman being together. So we tend to, and they tended to at the time, they called everybody being married. They called people the mother and the father. Sometimes they used that pronoun, the mother, the father, to kind of give it a little distance, you know, because everybody's, all these slave owners, they all knew they were wrong. I'm going to say this, okay? Read all the stuff. You'll hear it in the tone. There's always a tone of knowing, you know, there's something really wrong about this thing, but I don't, you know, even if they didn't know what. Anyway, so they distanced the mother, the father. They can't avoid that. Even when they're going to sell the children, even when they're going to sell the cook or sell, she will be sold without appendages, they say. Well, who the hell could the appendages be but her children? I mean, what are appendages? Do you see what I mean? So there's always this distancing kind of language happening in that as well. Yes, sir. This is where, within the culture, within African American culture, we have the tradition of fictive kinship. And of course, which means everybody would have when you had children, you wanted to make really sure that you had your children well embraced by the larger community. Because yes, you could get sold, and you would love to know that your sister, or the lady next door, or your great aunt, or however, was going to probably take care of those children. And that's how they would do it. So there's a lot of people, when we get post-emancipation, when people go searching for their kin, and even today when searching for kin within African-American genealogical circles, you often have this kind of interesting sidebar of fictive kin, the person that you grow up calling Uncle Beverly, Uncle George. Well, it turns out if you really look, he isn't even beginning to be a kin to your family, but when you were a little girl or little boy, that's how you called him, and you never had any idea that he was actually just the guy that worked in the same place that your dad worked, and who was just a close family friend, and you just always knew of him as Uncle George. So then years later, all of them are dead, and you've got a list of all your uncles, and you've got this Uncle George tacked on there that nobody can identify or find. Well, because he's not really. We have so many examples of people adopting and taking care of children that are not theirs, because and creating enough food are the two things that the community must do, can do, and does do. Yes?
The slave community also took care of the elderly, because apparently they were just sort of abandoned.
Well, they could be abandoned. In fact, there's states that had to make laws against selling superannuated slaves, which is a phrase meaning old and useless. Okay. And of course, when you see a law, you know that means somebody's doing it, right? And then if you see the same law, maybe slightly tweaked, 5 years later, it means they're still doing it. So yes, the selling of the elderly had to be vigorously, at least by law, it looked as if it was being, monitored. But regardless, yeah.
They just died.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, it was a pretty rough time. People died. People died from all kinds of things. Many things that today, and I'm trying not to be really harsh about it because I'm so old myself, I need to start thinking about this stuff. People died of things that we would consider more opportune illnesses earlier. Pneumonia was a great killer. Certainly gastrointestinal, just things that today with a little bit antibiotic you'd survive it and you'd be fine and you could still continue to help in your family or do whatever. And some people had just great constitutions and they helped and they kept doing what they were doing till they just, dropped. So we have a lot of nuances on that. But people, any person who was made vulnerable, today we might say immune vulnerable, or they're just not going to survive the latest cholera epidemic, or the typhus, or some kind of weird ague, or malaria, which was just really prominent around, or the illnesses caused by by hookworm, or just so many things that we don't have. And the reason that it's so, of course, among the very poor, these things always are exacerbated. But we got to remember, Eleanor Roosevelt and Franklin in the teens, when that first child, that child of theirs, 2-year-old, died of diphtheria. I mean, this is one of the most wealthy houses that could conceivably be imagined, with medical care of the absolute highest order, and they had to sit and watch the child choke to death. Okay, so when I say, it was a rough world, and that's the other part of remembering that kind of we are not they, and they are not we, and things were really so different in a lot of ways, that we have to kind of add those nuances when we think about it. Yes, ma'am.
Life and freedom.
Well, I think a lot of that is, it's 150 years, and there are a lot of places that are still, under the burden of that. It took 100 years for everybody to get the right to vote. So for a lot of people, they consider that the war was not over until when? 1965. Because if you can't vote, Well, because if you can't vote and your school system is segregated, and you have, you know what I mean? So, and then they would have faced, as again, you know, the North wasn't at some great halcyon, you know, place of non, no, it wasn't a melting mat. And then they actually backed out and let the South just take over. So there was, it was all hard, let's put it that way. So what most people did, from what I, and that's a, it's a, I've just made a very broad and glittering generality here, but often people who had great ambition, along with certain kind of opportunity or a certain whatever that is that that takes. People like the banker in Richmond, Maggie Walker, who came from people who, you know, those kinds of people. Okay, some people just managed to aggregate people around them who had that, and they did it for themselves, by themselves, with themselves. That's what Du Bois was talking about the talented tenth, when he created the Caramel Theater, which is about us and for us and by us. Well, that was because blacks had to have all those things. They had to make them themselves. They had to make their own colleges. They had to make their own high schools. They had to make their own grammar schools. They had to make their own businesses. And they had to make those businesses most often in situations of deep repression, where to be too successful or to be appear to step out of the bounds or to encroach on someone else's monopoly, say as a wheelwright or skilled worker, to try to keep your wife and your daughters at home or in school rather than working as maids or field servants, in many cases was literally made illegal. And the sheriff and others could come and literally put you in jail and put them in jail for not working out of the home. It meant that cities, even within the South, began to aggregate more of those people, partly to help make way for their people, for the rest of their people, to learn to teach grammar school so they could go back or go somewhere and teach, or to go like the Exodusters to take advantage of that little loophole in the homestead law and for both black people and women, and maybe go get a little bit of land for doctors to form communities safe when possible. Mount Bio, I'm thinking of one. Always under the gun, always under the gaze, and for those even more ambitious, often necessitating really leaving the South and going very, very far away to places, New York or Boston or Germany, which is where Du Bois had to get his PhD because he could not be admitted to any institution in the United States. So there's probably as many stories as there are people, but I will close with one. Who of you might remember or know of Mary McLeod Bethune, who was, of course, the advisor to, the Negro advisor to Eleanor Roosevelt during the war. Mary McLeod was born in a family of truly poor sharecroppers, but they had ambition, and they had a lot of children, and they were pretty good farmers. And so they brought in just those little extra nickels and pennies and dimes. And then they had this Mary, who was little and feeble physically. And they knew that for her to be out in those fields would kill her. So they all, as a family, make their minds up that they're going to educate this one. And that's how many a family would say, okay, George, it's you. You're going to go to school, you're going to do. Many immigrant families did that as well. Jewish families, Greek families said, Ralph, it's your turn. You're going to go do this and that way, whatever. You're going to help drag us out of poverty. So they sent her to school. And it was like, I don't know, a quarter a week or a quarter a month, whatever it cost. They were willing to do the hard work to put that money together to make sure that Mary had an education. And so when we see Bethune Cookman College, and we see the pictures of Mary McLeod with the president, we see a life that was exemplified not only her own excellence, which of course had to be the basis of that, But her family's commitment to making this child, a girl child, successful. So we would see that, I think, through many, many families. And these pictures reflect for us, this is Du Bois in this picture, so it's a particularly lovely one, but we see people who understand America. Remember the four things they did? Marriage, education, you know, land, those things. Why did they do that? Because they had lived in America for 247 years, and they were Americans. And they knew what it was to be an American because they had watched all these other people trying to be Americans. And they were not, they weren't mystified. They weren't confused. They just had been left out, you know, pushed out. But it wasn't that they didn't know what was going on, you know. And that's what these pictures, even a struggling family like this one with all their possessions in a bag, you know, carrying, trying to get somewhere. They are going to go somewhere. But I can't resist having to tell you. You know, we keep hearing, Alwyn, the word miscegenation, which is just an obnoxious word. But what's really great about it, it's an invented word, and it was invented in 1864 as part of a, some newspaper guys invented it in D.C. as part of a, they were doing a satire on Lincoln, and they, you know, because there was all kinds of rumors, you know, the rumor mongers at the time. It looked just like Facebook. I swear to you, it was just, if they'd had Facebook, boy, they would have gone to town. So they have, so there's all these rumors that Lincoln, of course, because he wasn't the most attractive of men, but that that he was a Negro, that somewhere in his, okay, so there's always these rumors in the moving mills. So these guys, they're actually, Republicans, but they decided to do this satire because they thought that it would kind of do, you know, how people do a really dumb joke and then it turns out to be really dumb. Okay. So they created this word, miscegenate, which is a nothing word. It doesn't really mean anything. Prior to that, the word for people of different races was marrying or having a relationship was amalgamation. To amalgamate was the term, which is actually at least it's a word that you could use in other contexts. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of things that amalgamate, and this is just one of them. Miscegenate only means that particular thing, which is what's so really ugly about it. But also, of course, it's become a source of immense amusement over the years as people have, you know, southernized it. And anyway, so there's this word. But just to show you, you know, the press, all of the influence that we have lived with over this last 150 years, you know, since then. Yes, ma'am. How things happen, this is so really cool, how stuff happens. You know, this brick falls there and then that goes there, whatever. Okay, so he's taken to Baltimore. He's been a baby minder in the house. Frederick Douglass, how did he self-educate or however? He kind of did a combination of all those things. He's taken to Baltimore by the mistress of the household who has a child just younger than him who he has been the baby minder of. And she, as part of her housewifely duty, her job is to give the first reading and writing lessons to the young children in the household. That's kind of the standard. And so, as a rather cute and kind of thing, not in any dead serious, you know, intellectual motivated way, but just because he was a young boy who was quick and bright, and she was used to him and he's taking care of her child, she tutors him in at least the beginning rudiments of the ABCs and perhaps the beginning of numbers. You know, they used to be taught as two separate crafts. So many people could write their name but couldn't read. You know what I mean? That's because they were not joined together. But he is quick and bright. Well, the father of the household finds out and forbids the child, the young Frederick, from doing that, and he sends him out into Baltimore to a shipping yard to work as a caulker. So in about 8 or 9, whatever it was. It's well worth reading his book and actually getting the details from him because he was a lovely writer. But he understands that he's poised. He knows enough to know that there's more to know and he wants to know it. So he suborns several little boys who he knows spend part of their day in school and then the rest of the day just rousting about, because in those days, you know, kids could do that. And he pays them, he earns money, and he either holds back the money that he's supposed to give his master, or however he does it, and he gives them in something, in trade, to teach him. So by the time he's ready to finally escape, he probably has been exposed to newspapers by this time. He's in Baltimore. Do you see what I mean? He has access to kind of secretive, low-key ways of embracing literacy. And so by the time he does finally escape and gets to Boston, he's ready for that big stage of learning. And I don't know the details of that, but it must have been intense, and he was very bright. And just as, you know, this country brought several hundred thousand Hmong villagers from from Cambodia in the 70s and 80s. They came to Minneapolis, and I was living in South Dakota, so it was something that I kind of was aware of. All of them got the hell out of Minnesota as soon as they had one winter there. But they went to Louisiana, to where it was hot. But in the meantime, a significant number of these adults went to night school. And these were people who were actually illiterate in their own language. And many of them not only became deeply literate, more than functionally literate, they became doctors, their children. In other words, if you're a smart, well-intentioned, you know, person, you can learn stuff really damn fast. And you can learn it well. And we have many, many examples of that kind of learning in our, you know. In Richmond, within 6 months of the end of the war, there were 2,000 black people going to night schools a night in the city of Richmond, wow, learning to read and write. Okay. So, you know, we have people learn. You don't have to just learn when you're 7 or 12. You can learn at any time if the rewards are going to be commensurate. I don't know the literacy history of Ellen and William Craft, who escaped, you know, up the Mississippi River as slaves, but they became literate and went to London and wrote a book and a biography. William Wells, Box Brown, he wrote, you know, people just, Linda Brent, who was actually Harriet Jacobs, wrote her book. And it was long thought that actually someone else had written it, but now we know that she actually did write this book. Well, she wasn't born reading and writing, and she probably didn't, you know what I mean? But she lived in a circumstance just enough such that she could.
And the desire.
Yes, desire, and passion, and then a little bit of an opportunity, and how much a difference that can make for somebody.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.